Welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And this week, Brexit bites. The impact of the fall in the pound is being felt as the cost of living continues to rise. Inflation up to its highest level in 4 years, but it's okay because, as we heard this week, unemployment is at its lowest since the 70s. And everyone knows that that, according to economic conventional wisdom at any rate, pushes wages higher, right? Well, not so much. The amount of money we're taking home is continuing to fall in real terms. Is it time to rein in the spending? It looks like we already are. The Bank of England, it seems, are still tolerating higher prices as they kept interest rates on hold this week, though three members of the MPC did vote to raise them by 0.25%. What impact will all this have on the economy? Also coming up, the drop in sterling's been good news for the FTSE 100, but is it now looking a bit too expensive? What does that even mean? Holidaymakers trying to mitigate the effects of the falling pound by using prepaid currency cards could be being stung in other ways, so watch out. And talking of being stung, the team from This Is Money have been busy uncovering the latest scams doing the rounds, so you don't have to the hard way. Find out what they spotted this week, all that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, £21.7 billion. That's the spare change UK households will apparently have to find down the back of their collective sofas just to maintain last year's standard of living. The drop in the value of the pound since the Brexit vote has increased the cost of imports, a key factor behind the rise in inflation from 2.9% last month from 2.7%. Prices are going up while pay growth is slowing, and it's impacting at the shops, with retail sales falling in May. Now, one figure that didn't budge this week was the interest rate. The Bank of England kept it on hold, while over the other side of the pond, the Fed raised theirs for the second time this year to 1.25%, the highest level since 2008. So putting these all together, what picture does this paint of a post-Brexit vote, post-general election economy for Britain going forward? Simon and Lee, a very warm welcome to you both. Simon, I thought not so long ago the big debate was all about deflation. Tell us a little bit more about these figures.
Well, yes, the concern about deflation was that essentially we were in this low growth environment, interest rates were low, there was very little inflationary pressure, and the big driver behind that was the fall in the oil price and the fall in energy prices. And also in this country, the supermarket battle. Now, what's happened since then is the big B word, and that is Brexit. So what we are now feeling is the after effects of Brexit. So if you look around the rest of the world, there isn't that much inflationary pressure still. There's a little bit of it because the oil price has gone up, but then the oil price has gone up and then slipped back and then gone up and slipped back. It's not done a sort of rocket back up to $100. It's kind of stuck around 50. So depending on how far back you're looking, there's inflationary pressure from that. But if we stay at 50, that will drop out. In the UK, however, the pound has fallen. The pound has fallen substantially against the US dollar, which is the big one, and the euro, which is the other big one. Now, a lot of stuff in the world is priced in US dollars, including oil, and we do a lot of business with the EU. We import a lot of stuff from the EU. And in fact, actually, against a whole basket of the world's currencies, the pound is down substantially since Brexit. And we are coming up to 1 week since that vote. So we will be basically a year on pretty much from that big fall in the pound. And the effect of that is that a lot of the stuff that we buy is getting more expensive. And that is coming through quite strongly in the inflation figures at the moment. We're up to 2.9%. Bear in mind that the Bank of England had previously said that we might only peak at around that level. To be honest, it looks like we've got further to go and we might be pushing up above 3%. Now, what that means for all of us is that basically the cost of living is going up, and it means that it costs us more money out of our wages to buy the things that we need to buy.
Drilling into that a little bit more, economics 101, how does that all work with the wage figures that we got this week? When we talk about in real terms, Lee, help us out on this one, and therefore, really, how worried should we be?
Well, what typically happens is when unemployment falls, wage growth pressure starts to go up a little bit. But what's happened is, unfortunately, where inflation has started to really sort of rocket in the last 6 months, inflation is now outstripping wage growth for the first time in the last couple of years. So not only are we facing up to more expensive shopping, bills going up, people's wage growth isn't keeping up with inflation either. And these are all sort of pressures that people are going to be facing on a sort of month-to-month basis. And if that continues throughout the rest of the year and into next year, you know, this is the first real test, I would say, in a number of years of people's actual finances and how they're managing. If people are on sort of real balanced books at the moment, people could really start to feel the pinch of this. But of course, when we do talk about unemployment, those figures, I mean, we have to say how many of these people are on zero-hour contracts, for example.
Well, that's it, because the unemployment figure looks great at the moment. It's a record high since the 70s.
Since the 70s. I mean, that is, you know, that's a very impressive thing to be able to say, isn't it? When, you know, unemployment in the UK is the lowest since the 1970s. You know, that sounds like a very good sentence. But what is the quality of these jobs, of these contracts that people are getting? What's the quality of the conditions and all of that sort of stuff?
Is that why you think it's not filtering through to wage growth? As I said earlier, the economic conventional wisdom would suggest that it might.
Exactly. But the wage growth actually hasn't been too bad in the last sort of 6 months to 12 months. But as I say, when inflation's biting the way it is, if you look at it, you know, on a graph, you will see that inflation is now outstripping wage growth. And that is not good news for the vast majority of people that may be sort of struggling to make ends meet.
I know, Lee, we always talk about our own personal inflation because it's this basket of goods and not everyone's been going on foreign package holidays and buying imported computer games. But those have been factored in, plus toys helping to push up the rate, but also marginally as well, the price of food and clothing. Fuel costs falling for the third month in a row. Who is being hit the most?
Well, when you're talking about, you know, this oil price, as Simon was just alluding to there, the oil price has actually been falling in the last few months because of some pressures out in the Middle East. That has sort of filtered through to petrol stations, so the cost of filling up a car has gone down. But the shop, as we warned after the Brexit vote, you know, the EU referendum, there was a lot of supermarkets, even the discounters, saying, look, we don't know how much longer we can hold off and not start putting food prices up. And I think we're starting to see that now. So in one hand, you could say, well, fuel prices are coming down, but on the other hand, food prices are going up. And it's as I say, it's a fine balance for many people out there.
Simon, how much of a fear, though, is there for an economy that is so dependent on us going out and spending? We got May's retail figures. They've fallen. Your correspondent, Alex Brummer, though, he argues producer prices have started to edge down and the squeeze might not be as severe as imagined. Also, when UK unemployment stands at 4.6% of the workforce and people feel secure in their jobs, they're unlikely to lose the spending habit. Moreover, as there are 400,000 more people in jobs than a year ago, that means overall spending power is increasing. Your thoughts?
I think that all of those points that Alex makes there are very good ones. One of the key things to watch is that producer prices element.
Because, what is that?
Well, it's basically the cost of inflation to the people who make the stuff or produce the stuff that we buy. Now, that obviously is hugely important because a business will want to protect its margins. It wants its profits to be maintained. It doesn't want its profits to fall. And so if its costs go up, and it wants to maintain its profits, then it's either got to suddenly become much more efficient, and bear in mind that a lot of businesses have done a lot of efficiency stuff, which basically is just another word for cost cutting, in recent years, or it needs to start raising prices for you and me, and Lee as well, he will have prices raised for him too. And I think the problem that, if you look at the economy as a whole, maybe faces in dealing with this issue, is that we have had a prolonged period of low business investment. Okay, the idea was, you know, that low interest rates and all this kind of cheap money basically would encourage not only people to spend but would encourage businesses to invest, and businesses have not been investing, and so those businesses are not in a position to suddenly be much more efficient than they were through upgrading their machinery, upgrading the tools that people use to do their work and all those other things, because they've not been spending money on that. What they have been spending money on is human beings, because human beings are relatively cheap compared to retooling your factory. You retool your factory, you've sunk the money into it, and that's it, the money's sunk and you've got to earn it back. You employ a handful more human beings to do some work. Well, you know, if business turns down, you just get rid of them. If they're on a zero-hour contract, you might not even have to pay any money to get rid of them. And we have the issue, of course, where, yeah, as Alex points out, unemployment is very low and people in jobs get paid and they spend that money. And people in low-paid jobs tend to spend considerably more of their wages than people in high-paid jobs. So actually, if you look at the lower-paid jobs and if you get more low-paid people into work, then probably a greater percentage of the money they're being paid does actually get spent. Yet the issue with unemployment is that The unemployment figure is great, but really what matters to you personally as an individual is, do you have a job? Mm. Right, okay. But once you're over that, do you have a job? Does that job pay you a fair wage, i.e. enough that you need to live on? Does that fair wage go up with the cost of living, i.e. is it enough to live on this year, next year, and the year after? And if you want to become more prosperous as an individual, and we want to become more prosperous as a nation, does the amount that you're being paid go up by more than the cost of living? And since the financial crisis, that has not been happening. My concern, and I think a great concern of the Bank of England's, is that the link between companies and pay and inflation has somehow broken down. So it always used to be the companies put your wages up by inflation. Now, you might get some kind of crash and you've got a pay freeze. I mean, we had a pay freeze immediately after the financial crisis. Some people in the public sector saw their wages continue to go up and then have had a pay freeze for many, many years, since a couple of years after the financial crisis. Or they might try and just put your wages up by less than inflation. But the problem is the idea is that after that short, sharp shock, the link should be back and the company does the right thing and it at least gives everyone the average pay rise, which is inflation, and hopefully it gives you a little bit more so everybody gets a bit more prosperous. And that link just appears to have completely broken down and people's wages are falling in real terms, which means that essentially, in layman's terms, we are getting poorer.
What will it take to get it back? Or is that it?
I don't know, because actually one of our other colleagues, John Rees, on Financial Mail on Sunday, wrote a very interesting column at the weekend where he pointed out that, you know, real wages in the UK are down, I think, 10% since the crisis. But in some of those countries that we look at as being in a much worse position than us, their wages have gone up in inflation-adjusted terms. So France, Italy, we don't look at them as being sort of paragons as economic virtue. In fact, we're in a club that includes Greece. And Greece has got a pretty good excuse for being in that club.
Lee, I just wanted one figure also rising that's of particular concern when you throw into all of this, as I suggested earlier, is rising debt.
Yeah, well, we've definitely touched on this this year, haven't we, Georgie, about the rise in debt and how the amount of money being bunged on credit cards seems to be going up at a quite gradual pace in the last few months. The big one at the moment that we keep talking about is car finance as well. Yeah. All of these things seem to be a real debt bubble. All it needs is one little prick and it's going to pop and it's going to be nasty. So we always echo this, but just make sure that you are protected when things are looking like they may be on the downturn and, you know, those debts start becoming, you know, way too hard to manage. We look at the moment, I mean, some of these 0% balance transfer cards, for example, you know, are going on for
months, 42, 43?
Touching 4 years. You know, zero. Yeah, people are just, I got a feel that people are just shifting this debt around and not making any actual inroads into getting rid of it. And again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about people really managing their finances on a tightrope. If you're getting stung on credit card interest and you can move it, then you should, but you need to have a plan in place to get rid of it and not just rely on at the end of that shifting it again, because in a couple of years time there may not be any 0% balance transfer cards.
Absolutely. Simon?
Yeah, Lee's right. And just to hang it on some figures, average earnings were up 1.7% excluding bonuses. They were up 2.1% including bonuses, but you know how many people get a bonus. So earnings are up 1.7%, you know, inflation's up 2.9%, so you're 1.2% behind inflation anyway, but that means that your earnings aren't going up by as much as the stuff that you need to buy, but then you've got debt on top of it that you have to service, which is then eating into your wages. And the problem is for people who are borrowing money in order to keep themselves afloat, is that if you borrow money because you don't have enough this month, next month you not only don't have enough again, unless you've done something dramatically different to change your behaviour or your spending habits, but you also have the need to start paying back the money that you borrowed. And with a lot of these balance transfer cards and the, you know, spending cards and everything like that, they're not offering these cards for altruistic reasons. They're offering them because enough people fall foul of some kind of catch or don't pay the debt off before the end that they end up paying whacking great rates of interest of 17, 18, 20%. And there is a scenario where at some point all of this consumer borrowing does have to stop and it can't keep growing and growing and growing and growing. I'm presuming there will actually eventually come a time where a credit card company doesn't come out and offer an extra month on a balance transfer card. I mean, I might be wrong. Come back to me in 2 years' time when you can get a 10-year 0% balance transfer card. I mean, at some point, you might even be able to stick your mortgage on one. But I think that there comes a point where this has to stop. And what sinks it will be something that comes from something that we're not talking about. It won't come from the things that we're predicting. Something will happen. It will come out of left field. And I'm pretty sure it will sink the whole consumer debt thing. There's been questions over the car finance stuff, whether that will do it. I mean, who knows? But in a game of musical chairs, eventually the last chair goes.
We laugh, but that's going to be a horrible time, I imagine, for a lot of people. I do want to ask you before we move on from this, interest rates on hold, but three members of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee voted in favour of a rate rise. Kristen Forbes, Ian McCafferty and Michael Saunders voted for a 0.25% rise. What do you make of that?
I think that is very, very, very interesting. Kristen Forbes has previously voted for a rise. She has been the one person who's done it. She was expected to do it again, but she's leaving. So the expectation was we might go back to a zero vote for a rise. So actually, to find out that not only has one person voted, but three people voted, maybe that tells you that the Bank of England might try and sneak up interest rates. And I have actually previously said, I believe on this very podcast, that I think we might see an interest rate rise before the end of the year.
Ooh.
But only to 0.5%, where we will remain for a very, very, very long time. But I made that prediction before the election, and I think the election stuff throws that into doubt.
The Bank of England, the argument to raise interest rates, has what they've done in the past perhaps added to where we're at now in a negative way?
Yes. So, look, I think that the Bank of England currently finds itself in something of an impossible position, mainly framed, again, by that big B word that we were talking about earlier of Brexit. I think what has become abundantly clear with the economy's resilience since Brexit, as we have discussed numerous times before on this show, is that the Bank of England probably could have raised rates a couple of times. I mean, we could have probably got ourselves back up to the heady heights of a 1% interest rate. Maybe we could have even gone to 1.5% if we'd have gradually and slowly raised rates. Then we would have gone into Brexit with a lot more firepower. Instead, we went into Brexit with rates at 0.5%, so we cut them to 0.25%, which was, you know, negligible in itself. We shook that magic money tree with a bit of QE and pumped some more free money into the banks and building societies to lend out on mortgages at a time when we were already concerned about how high house prices were compared to wages. We didn't really have anywhere to go. Now, the Bank of England, even with the extra resilience, is worried about the uncertainty in the future, and it doesn't feel that it can raise rates. But what's going to roll around next time won't be Brexit, because we've already got that, but it will be a recession, and we will have a recession eventually. And ideally, by the time that recession rolls round, we really need interest rates to have gone up so that we can cut them again. And if you look across the pond at the states, they are putting themselves in a so much better position to deal with the recession that they are also inevitably eventually going to get, because when they get that recession, they're going to have some more firepower. We are basically going to get a recession and find that we have almost no way of dealing with it.
All right, then, on that cheery note, we spoke about the rising cost of foreign package holidays helping to push the UK inflation rate up, the impact of the post-Brexit vote falling the pound. Well, one way that savvy holiday spenders have been trying to limit that pain has been to get a prepaid currency card and cut foreign exchange fees. Now, it involves some work, but you know you're saving money. Or are you? Well, only if you stay on the right side of some rather sneaky fees. Things like taking cash out and spending at weekends. Yep, that's right. Well, this is Money has been investigating. So, Lee, tell us more, if you would. Firstly, what are prepaid currency cards? How do they work? What are some of the more popular ones out there?
Well, so in simple terms, if you're about to go on a trip, you can go get one of these cards, you load it up with cash, and you should be able to take money out or spend in shops, you know, with your card, rather than carrying around big bundles of currency, which some people don't like to do, especially if you're on a 2-week holiday, for example, family holiday. Do you really want to take thousands of euros or dollars with you in person? Not really. So it's quite handy to have one of those cards.
Why would you not want to take your credit or your debit card?
Well, if you take your normal current account debit card, it's likely to have all sorts of charges, not only for ATM withdrawals, but actually just using it, you know, to pay for a meal. Not only will you probably get a pretty poor exchange rate compared to what you could get elsewhere, you're probably also going to get a non-sterling transaction fee on that as well, which can add, you know, some serious money onto onto a bill. So probably the most popular one, definitely one that many people would have heard of, is the one that's offered by the post office. Now, I'm actually not a big fan of the one from the post office, Georgie, I must admit, because actually they do charge for every time you take money out of an ATM. So it's not really that great, to be quite honest with you.
So you still have to take money anyway, so if you don't want to get charged, and then it defeats the purpose, right?
Exactly that. So, I mean, they charge $2.50, for example, if you're in America, per transaction. So the key is there, if you're going to get one of these cards, is not take out small amounts of cash. So, you know, you don't put it in and get $40 out. You're probably going to want to get at least $200-$300 out at a time. Otherwise, you're just going to keep getting that charge, which, you know, kind of defeats the object of taking a currency card. So there's that aspect. And then there's been a few new ones that have come out, including Revolut, which is like a bit of a startup. I saw it advertised heavily as I was coming into the building today on the tube. But actually, this is quite sneaky, and I didn't realise this before until we investigated about it. Now, not only do you have to pay to take one of these cards out, so it's £5 to get one of these delivered, or £12 if you want express delivery, which, you know, is a pretty sizable amount of money. But actually, what got me is it's more expensive to use at the weekend.
Now, explain this. This is quite cheeky, this is.
As I said, I didn't read about this. I'd never known about this before. But basically, they offer one of the cheapest exchange rates for people in the week. So it's real sort of live time. This is what's happening, you know, in the currency markets. But it applies a markup at the weekend when the currency markets are closed. So it takes the exchange rate at midnight on Friday and adds 0.5% to 1.5% to the rate, depending on the currency, until Monday morning. So that is pretty sneaky, isn't it?
Yeah, you worked out, what is it, $200 meal or something? Yeah. About, okay, it's 83p, but still.
But it's still cutting into your into your holiday money. So my biggest advice with this, and especially if you're going on a short holiday and you don't plan on taking much money, I would just take currency. I would shop around on the internet. You can usually get it delivered to branch, especially if you're in London. If you're in London, you're going to get the best rates because there's lots of competition. What you do is you go online, you order your currency online, and you go and pick it up in one of these exchanges, and you're probably going to be locked in to the best rate. Now, if you're uncomfortable with taking a certain amount of money, it's definitely worth getting a prepaid currency card or opening up a new current account or a credit card where you can limit the sort of currency damage. So, for example, I actually have a Metro current account. I don't use it unless I'm going to Europe. Actually, back in the day, I opened it because it offered worldwide spending abroad with no fee and a good exchange rate. So when I had a sabbatical in Australia, I opened up a Metro current account and used it out there. It was great. I loaded it up.
There's still lots of cards like that.
There's not. No. These perks have been sort of picked up a bit. So now Metro only offers that in Europe, which is still handy. A lot of people do have city breaks in Europe now. So if I'm going to Europe, I'll stick a couple hundred pounds in my Metro current account. I'll take a bit of currency and I'll use that as an emergency if I need to take more money out because there's no charge at the ATM. I mean, I think that's very good. Now, there are other options out there, but some of them do involve the dreaded credit card that we were just talking about today. So the Halifax have a Clarity card, which has got no charges on worldwide spending. So that one still has locked in. But as with any of these things, you have to check what kind of exchange rate you're getting and how it compares to other companies and if there's any catches. Virgin Money have fee-free spending worldwide. So if you pay in a restaurant or in a shop, but it does charge for ATM, £1.50 a go. And Nationwide, a select credit card, is only available to existing customers, but it's fee-free also for overseas spending. So these currency cards can be good, but you just have to look at the devil's in the detail. And as Simon mentioned earlier, these companies aren't just doing things for free to be nice. You know, there's ways that they're looking to make money out of you. So
it's all rather complex, though, isn't it?
It is a little bit complex.
Simon?
So I was on holiday the other week. We were in Mallorca, and I will read you. So basically, I have a Nationwide current account, and we tend to spend from this. It's a current account that I don't use. Put some money into it and spend from it. Now, this isn't the absolute cheapest way of doing it, because Nationwide used to be free to spend overseas, but then they introduced charges. But what they did is they introduced charges that were a bit lower than everybody else's. So as I already had the account, it was a convenient way of doing it. But I must admit, I keep meaning to open a Clarity card or a Metro bank account or something like that. But I'm looking here at my internet banking as we talk. So Cafe Nore, £69.80. This is what came out of my bank account in the UK. Non-sterling transaction fee, 62p. Hypercenter, Luc Mayor, £30.76. Non-sterling transaction fee, 81p. Hypo Centro, Luc Mayor, £40.33 non-sterling transaction fee, 81p. Non-sterling cash fee, £1. Non-sterling transaction fee, £5.28. Non-sterling transaction fee, £1.12. Non-sterling transaction fee, 77p. Non-sterling transaction fee, £1.21. Non-sterling transaction fee, 12p. Right, okay, the biggest one there was about £5, wasn't it? And that was from withdrawing quite a lot of money from a cash machine. Mm. But that all adds up,
doesn't it?
Over the course of a week, that's probably 20, 30 quid's worth of fees, maybe a little bit more. You go away for 2 weeks, you can double that. So if you want to stick an extra 20 or 30 quid in your pocket for a week's holiday, or an extra 40 or 60 if you're away for 2 weeks, then get yourself a better bank card or a better credit card and spend with that, because you're knocking on the door of a meal out there, aren't you?
Yeah.
And so why buy your bank dinner when you can buy yourself dinner?
Touché,
basically, there you go. That's why you should get a better card for spending abroad.
What better argument could you have than that? Well, coming up, we'll be talking about some good news for travellers, those heading to Europe. But I want to stick with currency markets, if you don't mind. So if you are one of these people that are so convinced you know which way the pound will go, perhaps it is time to put your money where your mouth is. Family Building Society has launched two Brexit bonds for the optimists and the pessimists among us. They pay just 1% over 2 years, so that's not particularly exciting. But what makes the difference is you make a call on whether you reckon sterling will be up or down by then, and you choose the bond to back your call. If you're right, you get a 2% bonus. Simon, what on earth is this?
It is literally my favourite savings product in recent memory, if only for the sort of Brexit bond name and the slightly out there idea. The concept that basically one of the hardest markets to trade or invest in notoriously is the currency market. So hey, why not gamble on getting some extra interest? But actually what this is an elaborate game of higher or lower. And who doesn't like playing higher or lower? So you put your money in and you choose the bond, whether you think the pound is going to go up or the pound is going to go down. You get your interest rate, which is 1% over 2 years. And if you get it right, you get an extra 2% interest rate bonus, so you get 3%. Now, obviously, you could probably get a better return than that by putting your money into something that somehow reflected the swing in the currency that was an investment, but then you would be putting your money at risk, and because this is a savings account, the money that you put in there is not at risk. But I think Lee has the definitive answer on this, because Lee knows how you can play this to your advantage. Lee knows how to win and win.
Go on then, Lee.
I too absolutely love this. I think it's brilliant. We've had such a lack of exciting savings news that anything, we'll just cling on to anything and people will get excited by it. So the fact that there's an optimistic bond and a pessimistic bond is just fantastic. They've looked at the Bank of England markets. So on the 28th of March 2017, the day before Article 50 was triggered, what you've got to say is, will the pound finish above the euro in 2 years' time for that? And if you get it right, there is a 2% bonus. So you have to open this account with £10,000. The best buy, a minimum of £10,000. The best buy 2 year fix. Currently, we're in a time of really low savings rates, and we were talking about inflation earlier. You just can't beat inflation at the moment with savings accounts. Well, this, if you get it right, just about perhaps beat it. that's looking at a very rose tinted spectacle. So the best rate on a 2 year fix at the moment is 1.8%, and it's just a bit of a novelty account, but people love that sort of thing. And I worked it out. Basically, if you put 20 grand in one of these for 1%, so you guaranteed 1%, you're going to earn £404. It's nothing, is it? Peanuts with people. But if you get it right and you get that 2% bonus, that interest actually goes up to £1,235. Now, very interestingly, you're allowed to open both accounts. If it was roulette, you could bet on red and black. This is a pessimistic, optimistic. You can have money in both. Now, one of our readers has pointed out that if you put money in both, so say £10,000 in both accounts, you'll actually, over the 2 years, get a 2.01% interest rate, regardless of which way it goes, because you're guaranteed that 2% bonus anyway. And that beats anything in our 2 year table. So if you want to play the Builder Society at its own game, you could put money in both accounts and get a 2.01%.
Do we know what the rate was on the 28th of what was it?
Yeah, 28th we do. The 28th of March 2017.
Like 1.15 or
it was
something like that.
I'll tell you exactly what it is. It was 1.1535.
1.1535.
Yep.
So what do we reckon? 2 years' time,
higher or lower?
I'm going higher. I'm in the optimist bond.
I will go higher.
I'm going to eat my hat if it's not higher.
Oh, there you go.
Great. So all we've got to do, all we've got to do now, is remember in 2 years' time that we had this conversation.
Also, and also pitch in $10,000. I think
our readers agree. Actually, I put a little poll in there to see how, if they were going to open one of these accounts, what they'd back, and 2/3 are saying optimistic.
All right then, so the pounds fall. We're going to continue with that. It's been good news for the FTSE 100, credited as it has been with boosting share prices, yet as major stock markets, including here and over the pond, have hit a series of new highs recently. Do they look, well, just a little bit too expensive? Now, this is something that, Simon, you took a look at on the investing show. Firstly, why are we seeing those record highs?
Well, that is actually a very interesting question, to use a politician's answer. And I think, okay, that underlying this is a change in sentiment amongst investors around the world. So set aside the effect of, you know, the FTSE going up because the pound falls, and when the pound falls, that gets translated back into bigger earnings for the big FTSE 100 companies. You've seen some high market levels all around the world, basically. Set aside the whole Trumpflation idea, you know, where basically Trump's going to chuck a load of money into the economy and that's going to boost the economy and stuff. Even aside from all that, there has been a different sentiment, and I think you can trace that back 12, 18 months, maybe. And I think people have got bored with being cautious. Ever since the financial crisis, you had the big fall, you had the big bounce back, but everybody's been so worried about everything. Everyone's been, you know, very cautious and don't want to really commit. People have been making plenty of money, but there's been this mood, overwhelming mood. And I think there's been a change in that mood over recent times. And I think that it just reflects human nature and how basically we can do one thing for a certain period of time, and then we have a tendency to get basically bored of it and decide, oh, well, we just might as well try and make some money now. So you can probably put all kinds of reasons down behind this, but I think a little bit of it is what gets called animal spirits. And the animal spirits are just, you know, a bit more spirited. People have got a bit bored of being cautious, and they were like, oh, well, I might as well buy and try and make some money. And that's kind of what's been chasing up prices around the world. Now, one of the concerns, certainly with the US, is that the US market is very expensive on valuation grounds and has been for some time now. The UK, bit expensive depending on what valuation you look at, but not too expensive. Other markets around the world, you know, varying around the place. And so we looked at the question of, are markets too expensive to invest in? Why does that matter? Because if you buy something when it's expensive, i.e. overpriced, then it leaves you much less headroom to make extra money. Whereas if you buy something when it is cheap, aka underpriced, then that gives you considerably more headroom to make money, and probably in most scenarios reduces the risk of you losing money. So we were talking about this on the show with Ben Kumar of Seven Investment Management.
And what conclusion did you come to? Can it be worth paying a premium?
Yes, because what we also talked about as well is it worth paying a premium? Because, you know, if you look at the US market, one of the justifications that gets put on its priciness is that the US is home to the companies of the future, to the companies that are literally changing the way that we live. Facebook, Amazon, Google, Netflix, Tesla, all of these companies, sky-high valuations placed on them. Some of them have a much greater record of making money out of people than others. You know, for example, Apple and Facebook, pretty good at making money. Netflix, Tesla, not so great, but, you know, if they get it right, boom. So there's this idea that you should pay a premium for this kind of stuff, just like you should pay a premium for quality, you should pay a premium for this idea of explosive growth, the companies that genuinely are changing the world. And so, yeah, you can kind of argue that, but it's very difficult to really make a great case for buying stuff when it just looks super expensive, because the problem is that the chance of disappointment if things go wrong is so much greater. You know, if you could buy Facebook shares when it's trading on 15 times Facebook's profits, then you've got a much better chance of making money than if you're buying Facebook's shares when they're trading on 40 times Facebook's profits. Because anything goes wrong, Facebook disappoints in its earnings, something blows up, some kind of problem, then all of a sudden it could get knocked back down to 30 to 25 all of a sudden, and you've lost a load of money. And also the other thing that we talked about is the fact that around the world, there are many places where you can basically buy into much cheaper. So if you look at global stock markets, for example, you could buy into the US on this valuation that's only ever been higher at the top of the dot-com boom or at the top of the sort of 1920s boom as well. Or you could go and buy into some Asian markets where they look very, very good value, where they're pretty cheap. It's a long-term game, and you shouldn't look at these things in isolation. You should use them as a starting point for your research.
Much more on your website, thisismoney.co.uk. Editor Simon Lambert, also Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce here from This Is Money, and I am Georgie Frost. We did get some good news for travellers heading to Europe this week. You know those texts you've been getting from your mobile provider? I don't think it can be just me. The ones making it sound like they've done this amazing thing by scrapping roaming charges just for you. Well, they have, but they had to. Thanks to new EU regulations, so anyone heading to EU nations can use their mobiles as though they were home. So no more bill shock as a result of surcharges for making calls, sending texts, surfing the web or downloading videos. But there are two issues here. One, we seem to be in the process of leaving the EU. So where does this leave this particular piece of regulation and indeed others like it? And two, actually the consumer group Which says the Rome-like home structure could leave some customers still facing higher bills. So, Lee, firstly, what is happening and why? And sort of what stories are you hearing about so-called bill shock?
Well, the bill shock has been one of those real classic stories that have been going on for a number of years where people go away and either forget to turn their mobile data off and they end up with absolutely astronomical bills where their phone might be automatically downloading emails and that sort of thing, or where children perhaps get an iPad and start roaming on the internet abroad, you know, without parents really knowing. And some of these things can cost thousands of pounds, especially if you've accidentally downloaded a film or something on overseas. So this EU regulation has been a couple of years in the making, and it's looking to sort of stop all of that. You know, if the EU is sort of like borderless and we can all roam around as we will, as we want, then why is it that mobile operators, who have a presence probably in most of these countries anyway, are charging people such astronomical amounts of money? And it's basically not
just us going over as well. I was hearing stories about people who live on borders of countries, particularly Poland and Germany, and they keep switching in and out, not realising, and they're getting charged tons of money.
I reckon that must happen quite frequently, because obviously I can definitely see why that could happen. So, you know, that solves that for the people there. But, you know, from a British point of view, how many stories have you read, Georgie, about people who have gone away and they've come back with this absolutely ridiculous bill, and you think, wow. And yeah, you feel sorry for them and you think, well, had you not seen that that's kind of what these mobile operators are hoping for? Now, you mentioned there about getting text messages. I'm with Virgin. These are the text messages I've got. I'll get a sore finger scrolling down. But this is to tell me about it.
Essay.
This is to tell me about it again and again and then here again. I've had five texts about it in a week or so.
Yeah, they're saying, look at us, we're so great.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. They've signed it. Hello, we've got some great news. From the 5th of June, you'll be able to use your UK text, minutes and data anywhere in the EU.
As though it's like they've done it. It's ridiculous.
Thanks, Virgin. But, oh, I really appreciate
you had
that.
To do it.
Yeah, so, you know, it is great. It is great news for people that go away quite a lot and, you know, do want to contact home. But I actually think it's a couple of years too late in a way, if you know what I mean, because a lot of people now, I mean, I don't really send text messages much anymore. Do you? I mean, I tend to get onto Wi-Fi and use WhatsApp or use Facebook Messenger. And I think that's what a lot of people were doing anyway. And probably mobile operators were kind of missing out a bit on sort of text messages and phone calls these days, because I can make a phone call now if I've got a Wi-Fi connection anywhere in the world, back home, as long as someone's got the same app. Nevertheless, it's good news. But
things to watch out for, though,
there
as well.
There are things still to watch out for.
If you go over your limit, that's just as is. You will have to pay extra.
You will have to pay extra. But interestingly with that, again, this was in one of my text messages I got, because I was actually in Paris. And it said, if you don't go over your package allowance, it's just exactly the same. So you're not going to get charged. But if you go over your allowance, I was going to be charged 45p a minute for a call, 15p per text message, but just £1 a day for unlimited data, which sounds pretty reasonable anyway. So it'll be different, I would have thought, elsewhere. But that's still quite encouraging if you have gone over your package. I don't think you can rack up a serious, serious bill like you would have potentially done in the past. But two massive things to look out for on this. Consumers definitely shouldn't think that this is a blanket, works every way, if you see what I mean. So if you're in the UK and you've got a family member out in Spain and you're phoning them, this doesn't apply that way round. So you are still going to get charged up to a couple of quid a minute.
Site, it's about up to 150 a minute if you're calling someone in Spain.
But again, a massive caveat on that is that probably people that do have family members out in Spain are on some sort of call package, I presume, to make sure that they're not getting charged £1.50 a minute to make phone calls. Now, the other one that actually I think is more interesting is to not get sucked in and think that places like Switzerland, Channel Islands, Turkey, you know, they're not part of the EU. So they're not applying on this. It varies from operator to operator. So what I would suggest, depending on who you're with, is to get the lowdown on this. There's loads of discrepancies. So if you're an O2 customer, for example, you will continue to be hit with roaming charges in the Channel Islands, the Isle of Man, Monaco, Switzerland. But if you're a monthly customer of O2, you won't.
Right, so the advice is check your tariff with the provider, shop around for the best deal at the end of your contract if you're not on it. Yeah. My concern as well with this, though, is I imagine these were, and they were, raking in some incredible profits for the mobile providers. Mm-hmm. Where are they going to claw that back from?
Exactly, Georgia. I don't know. I don't know how profitable being a mobile operator is anymore. Mm. I think the rise of the internet has really sort of killed some of these off. And also, I think what's happening more and more is that people are getting a little bit fed up with the high price it costs to take out a brand new phone. You look at the Samsung S8, technology is obviously vastly improved from back in the day when we used to get our Nokia 3310s and whatnot, and you used to be able to pick up a handset for £100. Some of these phones now, even if you get a monthly contract, usually start from about 40, 50 quid a month, then you've got to pay for the handset that's going to be about £600, £700. And I think a lot of people, because the technology has improved on these phones, are just hanging on to their phones for longer. So that sort of revenue stream's sort of getting cut a little bit as well.
It's not a bad idea, though, to hold on your phone a bit longer. There's so much waste.
There's so much waste. It really winds me up when I see someone with a shiny new sort of, you know, iPhone about a week after it comes out. It's remarkable, actually, how quickly we burn through this stuff. You know, nothing's built to last anymore. Or it probably is, but we just don't like outdated technology. I want to hang on to this phone for another couple of years. Why do I need another new phone? But you're right. I don't know where mobile operators are going to claw their money back from people that they sting for thousands of pounds for downloading a film.
Absolutely.
In Spain.
Well, Simon, I'd like to get your views on this, but also talking about built to last, how long will this last given we're not actually going to stay in the EU?
Yeah, we talked about this before, haven't we? This is something I'd be keeping an eye on, because we had said, well, you want to watch out for those things that the EU has protected us against, like roaming charges and stuff, and mobile operators rubbing their greasy little hands and thinking, ooh, 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 going to make some money when we leave. And then we found them all sending us messages saying, we're going to make it free for you to use, or putting out press releases, free for you to use. You might have to sign up for this package, but it's going to be free for you to use. You won't have to worry, but just like at home. And of course, that was because these rules were coming in. So we will see what happens in 2 years' time. I suppose it depends how we Brexit. Do we hard Brexit, soft Brexit, left Brexit, right Brexit, up Brexit, down Brexit? Who knows? Because that will have a reflection on how many of the EU rules we have to abide by. But there is a part of me that would like to think that the mobile operators would do the decent thing if we do leave and they don't have to honour this. But there is a bigger part of me that thinks that what they will do is try and claw some money back from us if we do leave and they don't have to honour this.
Surely we could bring it in, though, as a policy.
As an extra law in the UK.
Yeah, why not?
We could do. Yeah. It's not a bad idea.
There you go.
Right. Write to your MP.
Okay, we'll do. Tomorrow. Moving on, whatever you say about journalists, and I am one, the work they do in shining a spotlight on fraudsters and uncovering scams is absolutely vital. Now, this is something I know you are passionate about. This is money. And financial scams have been at the forefront of your investigations, particularly over the past year, but for way longer than that. But this week, you've been warning us of a number of new ones out and about. So we'll flip between one to other, if that's all right. But Lee, I'm going to start with you, being the scam man, Lee Boyce. Mm-hmm. Could a message sent to you on social media lead to fraud? How criminals are combing online profiles to scam you. What's this about?
So basically, there's a bit of an awareness campaign that has gone out about this in the last couple of weeks, led by Barclays. They've had this television advertising campaign where it shows actually how quickly, in 30 seconds, fraudsters can kind of go through your social media, so your Facebook, your Twitter, your LinkedIn, take this information and put in a phony current account or credit card application in your name. And actually, when you really think about it, there's so much information about you online, you need to start making some of these things more private. So what it's just trying to highlight here is just to say, stay safe. Don't be silly on social media. And I know it sounds very patronising, but it's remarkable how many people have their date of birth, have their address, put location on. If you do that, you know, not only are you going to be more susceptible to be defrauded, but, you know, some financial organisations will go, well, hey, this information was online, and they may block you from getting a refund. I'm not saying that necessarily definitely happen, but I think it really does pay to be cautious about social media and really think about what's going on your page. So one of the things that Barclays pointed out, and one thing that people probably don't think about too much, you think you're really safe, but let's say on your Facebook, you don't have your date of birth, you know, showing. But then you have family members that start messaging happy birthday on there.
Yeah.
Or might say, happy 25th birthday. Can't believe you're 25 now, blah, blah, blah. From there, of course, it's going to get your date of birth. You haven't physically put your date of birth up for everyone to see, but of course, it's going to look at that and go, well, it's not going to take a genius to figure out what your date of birth is. And they start to slowly...
So a picture of your birthday cake on Instagram
or something. Yeah. With your credit card in the background when you just bought something with eBay. No, I'm not going to that level. But yeah, it just pays to stay safe. So we've got these tips online about how you can stay safe. And one of them is to sort of monitor what friends and family are saying about you online and posting on your wall. And some of this stuff, you know, is pretty easy to know things, but it's worth... arming the knowledge and
absolutely and repeating it. Why,
and repeating
why
it,
not? Because we're still making those mistakes.
If it stops one person from being defrauded, then I'm a happy man.
Absolutely. Right, number two, Simon, we're going to go to you. Beware this phishing email sent by scammers who pretend to be the DVLA offering you a £240 car tax refund. What's this about?
So, the DVLA, are you owed a car tax refund? Has the DVLA just emailed you to say that you're owed £239.75? The answer to the question, if you get that email of am I owed a car tax refund, is no. You are not owed a car tax refund. What you are is the target of a phishing scam, which is telling you that you are owed a car tax refund, and brilliantly even has a bit at the bottom with a link where you can report what you think of fraudulent emails. It's a, I tell you
cheeky.
What, you know, it's a convincing email. Do you remember when Lee did that quiz of can you guess if this email is a scam or not? This one, I think many people, if they didn't think beyond the fact that no, the DVLA does not owe me £240, so why would it send me an email telling me that it did, would think that actually the framework of the email looks pretty good. But it is a scam. They don't owe you money. And the DVLA has said that they wouldn't send you an email telling you that they owed you money. And also, in most instances nowadays, there'd be no reason why you would be owed money. If you sell a car, you have to go online, tell them that you've done that, and then they automatically refund you the money. If you, you know, scrap a car or various other reasons, then it comes to you and there is no reason. There's just no reason.
Too good to be true? It probably is.
It is, yeah. Although it has just made me think something. I'm owed some money not on car tax, actually, funnily enough.
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm not owed money on car tax because that's on a monthly direct debit. But I haven't checked whether when I sold the car and told them to cancel the direct debit, whether they actually stopped taking the money off me. Also, and I am owed some money from a parking permit from Islington, and I haven't checked they've given me that money back either yet.
Do as so I you say, can not see, as we do.
So you can see why people fall for this stuff,
absolutely.
Can't you?
Absolutely. All right, Lee, the final one. HMRC warning over rebate text scam. Taxpayers told to ignore messages claiming they're owed a payment. What's this about?
Yeah, again, these ones have been doing around for absolutely a long time. Taxman, you know, getting in touch saying that you're due a refund and you're going to get it by clicking this link. Basically, it's just a scam. The HMRC spokesman says that it is a regular target of fraud, and that's right. We get lots of readers writing in. I look at my own email inbox. I get one a week, probably, saying I'm due a tax refund. All fraudsters are relying on, if they're sending out millions of those, is just for one person to click on that and, you know, you can put malware on your computer and defraud you. HMRC, most importantly, says that it will never send notifications of a tax rebate or ask you to disclose personal or payment information by text. So just ignore it.
Thank you very much. On behalf of everybody, keep up the good work. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk, download the app and follow us on Twitter @thisismoney @GECFrost.